Welcome to I Am, I Have, brought to you by Happiful Magazine and the Counselling Directory. In this episode, we're talking to the award-winning poet Holly McNish, ahead of her tour, her panel session at the free and virtual Hay on Wye Festival, and to mark the arrival of her brilliant new book, Slug and Other Things I've Been Told to Hate. My cheeks hurt from smiling and laughing so much while recording this podcast. We chat about pleasure in all its forms, societal conditioning, the simple things, and the kindness of strangers. Before we start today's episode, though, I wanted to encourage you to download the free Happiful app. With this, you'll be able to read daily articles, access Happiful magazine in its digital format, and search for mental health and wellbeing support in your area. Now, back to Holly. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. And we'd love it if you could rate, review, and share. It helps others to find us, and we read every comment you write. I'm so pleased to welcome Holly McNish, award-winning poet to I Am, I Have today. Holly is currently touring across the UK and will be appearing at the virtual and free Hay on Wye Festival alongside Pandora Sykes and Anita Rani on Sunday the 5th of June. Her brilliant new collection of poetry and prose, Slug and Other Things I've Been Taught to Hate, is out in mid-May. Welcome, Holly.
Thanks a lot. It's very nice being here.
Could you tell us a bit more about you in your own words and not the kind of bio that I've just read out?
Yeah, of course. I found this the hardest thing to think about. So I'm Holly. I'm having a lovely day today. I am currently sitting at a desk with the sun streaking onto my face, which is very nice. I'm quite tired after coaching football yesterday. And in terms of my life, I guess my job, I earn a living by writing poems and reading them to other people, which I love and still can't quite believe.
That's great, and slightly kind of underselling what you do, because it's, you know, we're going to talk about it a bit more, but I've been aware of your poetry for a number of years now, and I think it really captures a spirit that perhaps people who don't interact with poetry or listen or watch people performing poetry wouldn't necessarily think they would get from poetry. So we're going to talk a bit more about that. Maybe with your first I Am, which is, I'm a little bit obsessed with touch and pleasure right now. So I'm just going to sit back, drink my tea and say, right, come on, tell me, Holly, what's this obsession?
I've heard that some people don't like being touched and I totally get that. But I think after, probably because of researching for my last book, where there's a few sections about touch and pleasure, sexual pleasure and sensual pleasure and all of that kind of stuff, I've started to find it really annoying that pleasure and touch was so shamed as I grew up, and that it's so enjoyable, if consensual, obviously, and so free and so safe. So I think that's why I'm a little obsessed with it. I'm a little obsessed with the fact that I've sort of been taught that touching my own body is wrong. And having started doing that, not just recently, but, you know, not that early on in life, it's like, oof, this feels really nice. And it's totally free and it's totally safe. And like, no one's being harmed in the making of this film. But certain things that we've sort of shamed, some things that can give us the greatest and safest happiness in life. So yeah, I guess from that, and maybe because of lockdown and having been kind of on my own with my daughter, I live just with my daughter and me, and being so grateful to have this person in my house who like wants to cuddle me has been really amazing. And just thinking, actually talking to some friends with partners or other adults in the house, they haven't actually had that as much in certain relationships. It's not very touchy feeling. I think I just really like that. I'm not one of these people, not that that's a bad thing, but that stands in the street with like a free hug sign or whatever, though I think that's lovely. And I have taken a hug off somebody like that when I was feeling quite low one day. But I think not being able to touch people for a year really has made me think, I love it all. I love holding hands. I love getting massages. Eventually was able to see my boyfriend who lives like 300 miles away. And forgot how much I love massaging and all that stuff. And it's just, there's so much in life, isn't there, that's totally accessible and totally free, but we've sort of made it weird. So I'm a bit obsessed with that. And also looking at kids and my daughter and her friends, who do are much more tactile, the way that I sort of used to be with mates. And they're still doing each other's hair and hugging each other and, you know, bundling or whatever. And I sort of watch it and think, I'd love a bundle. But because we're so worried that everything's sexual, aren't we, as you grow up? It's like you stop touching just in case it's seen as sexual, basically. It's like, oh, I used to love bundling, my friends. Where did where did that go? So I'm sort of obsessed with those boundaries and why we've stopped, you know. I'd quite like my friend to come round and plait my hair, for example. I love people plaiting my hair. But I think as adults, things need to have a function. It's like you can only get someone to touch your hair if you go to pay a hairdresser and get it shampooed. Like you couldn't just say to your mate, you just like plait my hair like over and over again and pretend you're trying to do a style and then take it out again. Because we need to have a function and an excuse, and we need to pay somebody to have a massage table, you know, have the oils so it's official, so it's not sexual, so it can't be seen as weird. So I'm just working out how to, like, can I do that to my mate? Can I be like, do you know what, I don't want to chat over a cup of tea today, I'd just like you to like brush my hair.
Well, listen, and I, this podcast didn't be like, listen to that, come over and plait my hair. That's exactly what I want.
But then, you know, you might have some people like, I'll plait your hair. And then it's like, oh no, I've done it again.
It's so interesting what you say there. And there's so much to unpack, isn't there? So firstly, the idea that, you know, in lockdown, we've not been able to touch people. We've not been able to hug people. It, you know, it kind of creates that touch deficit, if you like, that you know, something that we took so for granted. One of my best friends, Tasha, gives the best hugs. I mean, kind of you have to tell her to stop because she almost squeezes your neck too hard. But you know, I've not had that for over a year, there is a real kind of, especially because we've been told to stay away from people, it's almost like touching has been unsafe in some way.
Yeah, that's it exactly. And I'm definitely not like, I'm still a bit uncomfortable with it, but I don't want to be because I do love it. Do you know the place I've been touched the best, apart from other like obvious experiences, but from like sort of strangers, I guess, is whenever I get asked to do gigs at doula conferences. Like, so I didn't know what a doula was before I did a doula conference.
Go and share it, because people listening might not be aware of.
So I'm going to probably say this really badly and have doulas after me, though they seem quite calm people generally in that job. But it seems to be somebody that like supports parents or a mother through birth, in whatever way that is. So it's like having a really, really skilled and helpful friend at your side through pregnancy, labour, supporting in birth if needed, and then afterwards, whatever you kind of need help with. I think it's a bit of a privilege thing because you have to pay for a doula. But they all seem to be people that go into it because they really just want to help new mothers feel much more comfortable.
Yeah.
Which I think you don't really go into if you're a bit of a git, I don't imagine. But at the doula conferences, when we were allowed to like sign books for people, people would give me a hug. I think the first one I said, oh, it's lovely being around people, but it's weird touring because I'm just always on my own normally in like a hotel room. And then you see like maybe 100 people and they're all laughing with their friends or whatever, maybe not laughing at my poems, but what, you know, having hopefully a nice time. And then they leave and then you're sort of just on your own. So you're surrounded by people, but it's quite lonely.
You're
so
on the somebody, other side of that.
Yeah, you're on the other side sort of thinking, oh, this is nice for it. But I would quite like to be in the audience with my mates, not watching me, but watching someone else. But afterwards, one of the women in the book queue said, oh, can I give you a hug? And she was a doula. And she gave one of those hugs, which I always found a bit awkward because they're just a bit longer than I'm used to. And a bit more like you've practiced or somebody's taught you how to like give a proper hug. And then the next person did the same. So then I ended up getting about 50 hugs off these doulas. But it was very nice after I'd like eased myself into it.
Because we do, don't we? We have to kind of, well, I do, kind of let our guards down to be touched in that way. And I think,
yeah,
I think definitely, you know, coming out of the pandemic, we've missed being touched, but also there's going to be that hesitancy for a little while, which is like, are you good with being cuddled? Are you good with being touched?
But maybe that's good. Maybe that's like we're all starting to ask permission, which maybe we should have been doing anyway for certain things. Be like, are you all right with this? Because some people really don't like it, do they, for whatever reason in life.
But I wanted to touch on what you were talking about in terms of, you know, masturbation and touching ourselves and it being free and great. We can do it whenever we want to. I mean, within reason, obviously, but, you know, but it is something that we're kind of, I mean, I don't know, it's the same in every family, but we are brought up with certain parameters around our sexuality, you know, when it's, when it's, whether it's okay to touch yourself, whether it's okay to self-pleasure. And you work with Durex on a campaign where you did a fantastic poem called Intimate Talking, was that right?
Yeah.
Where you kind of talked about the fact that we can talk about politics and everything in the world apart from actually how we like to be touched or how we want to be touched. What is it? What's going on?
I think just because it's scary, isn't it? And you don't, I think we get this like one idea of like what sexy is, like of any gender that you are, like one idea of sexy, like rammed down our throats or in our brains or whatever, all our life. And I think it's nerve wracking if you think, oh, I don't find, like it's so monotone, the idea of what sexy and what sex is.
Yeah.
So I think there's a fear if like you're brought up and you haven't talked about it. So I didn't really talk about stuff. And I remember for years, which I've heard a lot of women say exactly the same thing, like a lot, saying, oh, I just don't find sex that pleasurable. But they're not talking about sex in all its forms. They're talking about like a few thrusts of a penis inside them, really, like if I'm being blunt about it. And there's also lots of men that I've heard now talking about saying, actually, I don't, you know, I also like the soft touching and tickling and all the other stuff, which is seen as like too feminine for me to like. I think if you, you know, put yourself out there and open up. We live in a society where that's sort of like anything that's not you being like three thrusts on top of you in a bedroom while your hair looks neat and you're wearing like a gold bikini or something is seen as odd or weird. So you don't know, do you? You don't know what the other person thinks. You might have really different sexual tastes to the other person. So I think it's scary. Yeah, and especially in a world where it's like this is sexy, you're a weirdo, basically. There's like the two options. And it's odd opening yourself up. And especially, I think, well, not especially, but a lot of women that I've spoken to about like orgasms and stuff, there's so much that you're told about how you should have an orgasm and what should make you have an orgasm. I say in heterosexual relationships, really. Yeah. I think that is, that's the main stickler. And a lot of women that I've spoken to in my 30s sort of didn't believe it themselves, that the way that they orgasm was like all right. And there's about thousands of years history against that, or at least, you know, hundreds. And I don't think Freud and people like that helped, you know. They've had very set ways that people, you know, women should orgasm like this and not like this. And if you orgasm like by touching the clitoris, you call it like an immature orgasm, and you're like a child, and a full woman should only orgasm from a penis inside her, and all this different, like it's a long history to battle against.
As much pressure, you know, even more pressure.
I know. And the timing, you know, if you watch sex on TV, most women sort of come at the same time as the guy or before, or, you know, the guy walks in the room and they're like, oh, it's ridiculous, really. And it's put so much pressure on everyone. So yeah, I think it's really hard. And also with masturbation, I think, well, I guess it's a lot of certain aspects of different religions which kind of have to been to blame. Like if pleasure is seen as sin, then masturbation is like the greatest sin, really. You're not doing it for anything other than pleasure. There's no reproductive aspect to it. So I think that, I'd like to say it was other things, but I think it's probably different aspects of religion, certain religions and certain parts of them, which has shamed that for so long. But I find it incredible. Like that in lockdown was also amazing. Like touching my own body.
Yeah.
That was an amazing thing to do during lockdown. And I find it strange. We're kind of still at school allowed to talk about heterosexual penetrative sex because there's the possibility of a baby. Like we're still kind of stuck on that. But the actual really, really safe, sex, like the safest sex, is just masturbating. Yeah, it's strange. I find it strange that I was taught to put a condom on a carrot as like apparently the safest form of sex. But that's not the safest form of sex, is it? It's like the second least safe form. So
I find it so interesting. We had a lady called Lahani Noor on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and she's a psychosexual therapist.
Yeah.
And we were chatting about performative sex that you see on TV and how that kind of sets a bit of a standard. But, you know, she says, and she's got this great audiobook called 12 Steps to Sexual Reconnection. Nice. And in it, she talks about all kinds of sex. So sex with yourself and sex with couples, mutual masturbation. And, you know, she was saying what you see on TV, you know, that's performative sex. That's where all the cameras are in the right angles. And, you know, if you go into most couples' bedrooms, you know, there will be times when it doesn't look that pretty and it's just kind of normal, you know, but it's not about that. It's about the feeling. It's about your feeling. It's about your connection. Yeah. And it just got me thinking about how we are constantly being fed these kind of visuals of what we should be like and how we should perform. And if we're, you know, even with masturbation, with some of the adverts for, you know, sex toys, you know, these are the sexy sex toys and this is what you look like when you're having great sex. It's like, well, no, it can be a bit pedestrian actually.
And normally it is, I think. Yeah. Like, I don't think people, I do think people look good when they're having sex because it's sexy, like, to whatever face you're making, whatever you're doing, like, that's what you want, however you're smelling, like, I think it's great. But yeah, it's such a clean, like, we're so, oh, I'm just so bored of the, like, politeness in our society, even in the sex scenes, which is not meant to be that polite. It's just dull. And yeah, exactly, like, the way that you're meant to look, like, the way you're meant to look, I know, like, look for some people is a turn on, obviously, which is great, like, great if it does. There's certain fabrics that I find lovely against my skin and certain things I wear which make me feel sexy and all that, but we're so obsessed with the way everything looks now, aren't we? It's like we're obsessed with the way food looks, and apples have to be a certain size and shape in the supermarket to sell, and we've only just started selling the, you know, the carrots that might be a bit wonky. Like, we're so obsessed with how things look rather than how they taste or feel. And I think, like, it just messes stuff up, doesn't it? Like, if you're even once having, like, really good sex and then just think, oh, but, you know, the folds of my belly at the moment look a bit rubbish. Like, the other person's never thinking that. Like, never. And it's just, it's so annoying how much it ruins so much pleasure. Like, this obsession with, even the sex toy stuff I find interesting at the moment, because there's obviously so much more coming out about female pleasure right now. Like, so much more, which is brilliant. And there's loads of, you know, people doing, like, lines of sex toys to, like, mainly for women masturbating, they seem to be sold for, well, the ones that I'm seeing, so it's probably just targeting me. But there's so much more about female masturbation coming out that I can see. But I don't want that to be picked up on these industries, as if, like, there's a few young girls that I've spoken to that don't seem to think that you can masturbate now without a sex toy. Yeah. It's like, oh no, don't, like, let's not go, like, that way. This is so good that it's getting the ball rolling and you're talking about it, and it can be great obviously with sex toys to do stuff, but like you say, now it's like, okay, so this is how to masturbate. It's like, oh, I don't know, I'm in two minds about all that stuff, because I use a sex toy sometimes, but mainly I just use my fingers. And the idea that we're now saying, in order for you to feel pleasure, young female or older female or whatever, you have to buy this vibrator, which is like £80 sometimes. Like, it's not cheap, the sex toy industry.
It's also giving that, I can't think of a better word, it's giving that power away, isn't it? It's like you have to rely on something external to you to give you this pleasure, and actually it's all within you. It's completely all within you.
Yeah, it's totally within, and you need to practice. Like, I was rubbish at masturbating when I started it. I think, like, especially with, if you've got, like, vulva and a vagina, it's not so obvious as a penis. And I know loads of boys that I spoke to at school, you know, they were sort of, you know, working out how to, like, slow down the ejaculation and stuff, and like, oh my god, this is so embarrassing. I think that must be really embarrassing, getting erections and stuff. Like, I'm so glad we've got, oh, I've got this genitalia, which is so secret. Like, I get so horny sometimes and I think I'd be, you know, deemed illegal if I was a guy half the time, I think. So that must be really difficult to deal with, I think. Like, I think, oh my God, I'm so lucky. I can sit here, like, on a train vibrating and thinking, oh, but no one knows.
You've got no idea why I'm smiling.
Yeah, no idea. I'm sort of clenching inside and stuff. But yeah, but I got better, and I've got much better in my 30s, and I've got much better in lockdown, and I'm still, you know, actually learning, like, oh my God, that's a great way to touch. And there's so many different ways to do it. And but it's the embarrassment. Even when I'm on my own, I remember being like, oh, I think that would feel nice. But now I look ridiculous. Like, I think I was too much info. But me and my friend were talking about how you sort of see masturbation portrayed, or how you might do it if you're with a partner and they're like watching. And then we were saying, all right, what's the most ridiculous situation you've been in? And I remember once thinking, oh, I want someone to touch my boobs. So I sort of put them against the warm radiator. and then afterwards I was like, this is ridiculous. You're like crouched on your floor with the radiator. Like, this is real, but yeah, I've not seen this in a film. More and more we are, though. There's a few programs now, aren't there, in films which are getting there.
Definitely. And I think it is that kind of relearning that we're not about someone else watching. And that's really hard. You know, when we're on our own, when we're masturbating, when we're doing anything, I think it's good to listen and understand when the inner talk is about what would someone else think, or through someone else's eyes, because we're so conditioned to be thinking about what other people are looking at. And it's like, no, this is just me. This is the person that was born into this world. And Porna Bell, again, she was on the podcast and she's written a book called Stronger, which is about physical strength. Yeah. But she said, you know, our bodies are the only territory, are the only land that we come into this earth with and we leave this earth with.
Yeah.
You know, and from, you know, kind of sexual assault aside, nobody can take that from us. So that's yours. You know, you don't have to mold that or be anything for anyone else. And I think, absolutely, but you know, do I practice it daily? Nah, not at all. No.
But how awful. I get really angry when I'm on my own if I do that to myself. Like, if I'm on my own with no one there and I'm doing something fun or whatever, or maybe I'll walk past the mirror and like glance at the mirror, or I'll just suddenly like look down and like say, oh, like criticize whatever it is about me. But then having that argument with yourself, thinking, I cannot believe that I live in a world that has conditioned me so much that even when I'm on my own having a nice time, I'm still like disappointed at my own skin, which has done nothing wrong and has been keeping me like cooled and warm and waterproof. And like, it's really amazing, isn't it, the body? Like, the more I learn about it, I had that when I was pregnant as well. And after, I felt really weird when I was pregnant. And then about 3 years after, I went to a midwifery conference where they were talking about the internal workings of a pregnant body and everything that it does to like grow this baby and change your food into milk. And like, it's magical. Fascinating. Absolutely magical. And it's the same with everything, isn't it? The way your nose is sloped so you don't like drown when it rains. Like, there's so many little aspects of your body which are unreal. The fact that you can make tears, I've been writing so much about that at the moment, the fact that I can like think about something and there's one, at one split second, that thought like becomes a tear. It's like, that's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Why am I standing here like criticizing the fact that I've still got like some marks from having given a baby, like, yeah, had a baby inside me? Why am I not thinking, oh my God, your nose slope is just so clever and your eyes making those tears is so amazing. Like, that's what we should be thinking. Well, it's very hard to think like that in this world.
and also that inner conflict. We have to give ourselves a break for that inner conflict as well of like, I've just looked at, I mean, I went swimming this morning and I literally went, oh my, and no, stop. Also, Lucy, you work for Happiful magazine and every day you're writing about, you know, accepting ourselves and, you know, so I think we have to give ourselves a break with that conflict is being human. But what I really hope is that everyone listening to this now is kind of touching their nose and thinking, how amazing.
And totally. Yeah, I think that's right. And also give yourself, like, I think I have to give myself a break from the sort of loving yourself idea as well. Like, if I'm not being so positive about myself, it's like, that's all right as well. Because adverts and every, you know, people are making a hell of a lot of money out of making us criticize ourselves. And if that didn't work, they wouldn't pay millions of pounds to TV companies to put an advert on in between, you know, X Factor and something else. Like, it works. That's why they pay for it. If it didn't work, if these adverts didn't work in making us feel like we needed to buy more stuff to improve ourselves, then they wouldn't keep paying to put the adverts up. Nice. So it's quite a big giant that you're fighting against, I think.
It is. And before we move on from talking about our bodies and how they're perceived, I just wanted to come back to one of the poems you did. I haven't written down when you did it, but it's called Embarrassed and it's about breastfeeding. This is one that really stuck with me because you talk about the fact that there are tits everywhere. So there are tits on billboards, they're in your newsagents when you go in for a magazine.
Yeah.
And yet people are so judgmental about breastfeeding that you were talking about being a mother who ended up, you know, going and sitting on a toilet lid and yeah, no more. So tell us a bit about that.
I wrote that poem on my phone when like one person made a comment to me about breastfeeding. I didn't have a lot of people like awful about it. When my daughter got a bit older, when she was like 8 months, people were like, you're not going to stop now, is it not a bit weird now? Like there's quite a lot of pressure as soon as your baby isn't a totally tiny baby as well. But yeah, I just felt so weird doing it. I felt like a cow was the first thing I remember thinking when I started breastfeeding, and I had it, but I hadn't seen anyone breastfeeding. Like I was the youngest of all my cousins. I don't have a little brother or sister or anything like that. I just hadn't seen it. And a lot of my, well, a few of my family members that I saw have a baby, they didn't want to try because they felt really weird doing it, which is not something to frown upon. It's hard not to feel weird doing it in this culture, I think. But that day I'd gone into a cafe and my daughter needed fed and I felt too embarrassed to feed her in this cafe. But after I fed her, she would always fall asleep. So I could have been like sat in a cafe with a sleeping baby having like a cup of tea, which would have been amazing. But instead I went into the public toilets in Cambridge where I was living and fed her on the toilet and she fell asleep, like as always. So I ended up sitting on the toilet. So I'd done that a lot, but that was the last time I did it. But I ended up sitting on the toilet for like 45 minutes while she slept because there was no point in, you know, you lift up a baby and they wake up again and you're so tired. So I was just sat on the toilet. I guess when you're stuck in the toilet with time to think, I just hated the world. Like I could not believe that after all you go through being pregnant and having a baby, like it's hard. I found pregnancy hard. I was sick, my back hurt, like it's really scary. I had nightmares all the time that I was going to give birth to like an animal or my body was going to rip apart or all this stuff. And then after I had a baby, I couldn't believe that like feeding her, like you have to feed a baby, otherwise they will die. And I couldn't believe that I lived in a society that made me feel genuinely disgusting. And even when I was on my own sometimes with her, I felt really weird. And that is not like that, nobody's making me feel like that apart from our culture. Like physically I found it really easy, and I know not everybody does, and the milk didn't come easy at first, but I just sort of sat and waited and stared at her and stuff. And you know, people have a hard time breastfeeding, had a bit of cramping but nothing much. But my main problem was just our culture. And the thing with all the sort of sexual breasts pictures that we see everywhere, when I put that poem up online, it was about 2 years later, and I wish I'd have put it up the day I wrote it so that I could have had all the support that kind of flooded in when I put it up.
Right.
Because I didn't put it up because I didn't, like genuinely did not think anybody else went into toilets to feed their kid. I thought it was just me because I didn't really have any friends with kids. And then I did like a book with poems in it, but I didn't put it in that book because again, I didn't think anyone would relate to it. And when people did, it's just so crap really. And it's not, I'm not saying that you shouldn't, because sometimes you don't want to feed in public because sometimes the baby comes off your boob and the milk flies everywhere.
But that's your choice.
But yes. I feel like choice is a funny thing with breastfeeding, because it's really hard to choose to breastfeed in our culture. It's really hard to choose to breastfeed in public. And if you can't breastfeed in public, it means you're pretty much stuck with your whole life going places that you know there's like a John Lewis changing room, basically, or something, or just staying at home, which is horrendous with a new baby. But a lot of people, when I put that up, that there was quite a like, yeah, this is awful because boobs are not sexual. I should say breasts, but I still feel weird saying breasts because it's very adult.
I prefer boobs.
Me too. Boobs or breasts are not sexual, you know, they're there for feeding a baby. But I find that argument unhelpful as well, because my nipples are like one of the main erogenous zones that I have. They're so sensitive, and I know some people's aren't, but I don't find that very helpful, because that also makes people feel like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be finding mine nice to like have a person licking. I just think they're just like any body part, aren't they? We have hands that will like be wanking someone, and we also hold our kid's hand, and we also might like hold our grandma's cheeks. Like, we do different things with every part of our body that feels different.
Yeah, we're multi-layered beings with multi-purpose limbs.
Exactly, but because nipples, you just see it sexually all the time. I think a lot of people, well, I did, breastfeeding just felt really weird. Like, this was not, it was just sort of not okay, which is awful, but they're both okay. What I really would like in my head, and I want to do it at some point, like a video or a picture, where you've got like a picture of a baby feeding and then a sexual picture of somebody like licking somebody's nipples just together. It's like, these both happen and they're both fine. Like, both
and that's
of them
okay.
Are fine. That's okay. Neither of these is weird. That person sucking on that boob isn't probably wanting to be a baby, maybe in a fetish way. You might, but generally not. Either way, fine. That baby, you know, that woman doesn't think that baby is a lover. This is also fine. Like, let's just get over it. Yeah. They're both fine.
And let's appreciate the kind of duality of a being, in a way. It's like, you don't stop being sexual because you're a mother.
No.
But also, that's not a sexual act when you're feeding. Like, get over that. No. Whoever's watching and judging, both can exist in one person. Just let that person be what they're being and eat your cheese on toast.
Totally. And and if you feel awkward about something, genuinely, and I probably not that I shouldn't say it, but I still sometimes feel awkward when I'm with a friend and they start breastfeeding. Like, I breastfed for like nearly 2 years, still feel awkward seeing it. But it doesn't, if something makes you feel awkward, I think we've got a tendency to think that means it's definitely not normal or it's wrong or it's weird. But it's not. It's just that I find a lot of things awkward. Doesn't mean that they should not happen or be banned. It's my problem. Like, that is my problem, and it's the culture I was brought up in.
I mean, we've just got to keep on talking about this, which is why I was very glad that your first I am was what it was.
So, oh, good.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And we're going to move on to the next one, which is, I'm very easily pleased by getting on a bike and cycling somewhere, even for a few minutes. I hate walking, though.
That's it, really. I feel very lucky. I don't think I've really ever suffered from mental health problems, and I don't know what it's like to have anxiety, depression. I don't know what it's like. So I just can't comment on things like that. I just feel really lucky that for most of my life, like, there's certain things I love, I guess, like what we've been talking about, that are, apart from the cost of a bike, like, they're free. And if I'm in a bad mood or feeling a bit sad, and I just get on my bike, pretty much feel better quite quickly.
Sorts you out.
I'm not saying if like big things have happened, but like, I don't cycle. I'm not like a cyclist. I'm not very fast. I don't need a streamlined lycra outfit because I'm not trying to win a competition or anything. I'm, you know, not that that's a bad thing, but I just mean, I'm not like, you know, it's not sort of competitive. I'm not doing it to lose weight or get a better figure. I just love moving faster. And the reason I think I hate walking is because I'm short. My legs are really short and I feel really slow. I think that's probably why my mum's like nearly 6 foot, and I just spent my entire childhood like loving her, but trying to keep up with her walking pace. My boyfriend's 6 foot, and like, I prefer roller skating or cycling next to him. I like having wheels on my feet, and I love the idea of just going fast somewhere. And I guess I love roller skating, but roller skating, you get more, again, shamed for doing it as an adult, because adults apparently aren't allowed to do anything that's fun and free, because we have to pay for everything that's pleasurable. I just love the feeling of like getting outside and getting on a bike. And I also feel really safe on a bike, and I don't feel safe walking because I've had too many people like follow me, like strange men sort of following me in different places and parks. But on a bike, I feel like I can make a getaway. Yeah, I just love it. But I feel really lucky that that makes me feel a bit better. Like, I've got on my bike when I've been like grieving. Obviously, it doesn't make me feel better that I've had, you know, friends who are now, who have died. You know, I'm not saying I get on my bike and think everything's fine, but it's just, I just feel like I can sort stuff out in my head quite well, and I like that.
I think movement does that a lot, and movement for joy especially, you know, it's something that can take us back to a certain state. Did you cycle, did you have a bike when you were little?
Yeah.
And did you go out on it a lot?
Yeah, a lot. Not at all relevant, but my bike that I've got at the moment, I can't touch the ground when I'm on it, so it's sort of that thing that you tell kids not to do it. But I had, so I think it was like my dad's bike or my older brother's bike that I had the hand-me-down of, so I couldn't touch the ground. So I remember I could only stop when there was like a curb or if I sort of came off the seat and did that, but it was the bar in the middle was a bit dangerous to do that if you do it too quickly. So I remember I used to, not always, but I remember at the sort of 12 I must have been, I had, yeah, or maybe I wanted to use that bike. I'm going to make my parents sound bad here if I say that they gave me a bike that I could only stop on curbs, but I remember at quite a lot of points in my life doing that. And now I have to do it again, and actually I find it really, really quite sweet. I'm quite loving the fact that I can't really reach the floor. Maybe it makes me feel a bit like a kid again, I'm not sure. It's just very freeing.
I think there's something about, as you said, being able to do something that's free and accessible, and it's within your power to just get up and get on your bike and go.
Yeah, and I like getting places. I don't have a lot of time. I live on my own with a kid, and as a, I don't say single parent because I like co-parent with her dad. But as a, someone living alone with your kid, you like, you cannot leave the house in the evenings. It's such a big deal when you're on your own as a parent. You can't just pop out anywhere. Like, you either take your kid, which is not always pleasurable and is much slower, or you're just stuck in your house. So I think the fact that I can like cycle places, yeah, it's really nice. When I don't have the opportunity, I don't think as much as other parents, to just go out on a bike ride or leave the house ever.
So, I think it's great to continue something you really love as a child. And as I mentioned, I went swimming this morning, and it was something I used to do a lot. I was swimming in the pool the other day, and I had to call my mum afterwards because my mum used to take me swimming regularly, but she didn't swim at the time. Oh. And literally I had this kind of flashback of looking up and seeing her in the swimming pool in the little kind of viewing, they had like wooden seats, and I could just remember kind of seeing her watching and waving. And then we always had like a hot chocolate and Frazzles afterwards.
Yeah,
and I had that so kind good. Of feeling of like, I like doing this just because I like doing it, not because like I'm not trying to lose weight or I'm trying to improve my time.
Yeah,
just literally this gives me really nice feels.
Oh, it's so nice, isn't it? And that's so lovely that you say that about the Frazzles, because I had the same thing after swimming. And I think maybe it's because we're like older parents now, so we're more worried, or there's more stuff that we're reading about it, or there's more social media, you know, pictures of nurseries.
Yeah.
But all these, like the amount of money, I wasn't planned to have a baby. I wasn't really very prepared at all. And I was like 26. I didn't really get a lot of stuff that a lot of people I know now are getting for the baby. But all my memories are exactly like that. It's like being able to get a bag of chips after swimming, like that's it. That's like the joyous childhood memory. And it's the same with me. If I take my daughter swimming, then we'll get a slush puppy and a bag of crisps after. And I'm sure of all the things I've worried about, that's going to be it. She's going to be like, I'll remember those slush puppies we had after swimming. I absolutely love swimming. It was always a sport. I was quite sporty at school, but swimming was not at all one that I was good at, but it's now one of my favorites. But at the moment, I normally go swimming and I take three kids, and then sometimes go with another mum or just take the kids. And I love diving in, I love bombing in, I love jumping in, and I love that sort of swimming. So at the moment, I was so excited about pools opening up after the last lockdown, and I went, and it was all, you know, lanes, and you had to book the time.
Yeah.
And I went, and I was like, oh, I do like it, but I like going under the water and trying to do roly-polies. But I did that, but again, it's sort of frowned upon, and I don't really just like doing length. So I'm waiting for all that to be off, or that I can go to the sea or something, because I just love jumping into water.
It's like the family session in the middle of the day where it's just like a free-for-all, you know, and you can practice it in handstands in the shallow end so that your legs are poking out.
Yeah, I don't want to do breaststroke up and down. I want to like dive onto a lilo.
See, I think today the theme is definitely, you know, those simple things that bring us joy and that are kind of within our capabilities, you know, yeah. and remembering the things that brought us joy when we were little that weren't about those kind of outward gaze, how something looks,
totally.
You know, or yeah. what someone can sell us. And your next I am, which is really lovely, is I'm thankful that little things make me very excited deep in my belly, like sitting in a cafe to have a cup of tea, or seeing heavy rain, or reading a book next to my daughter or my boyfriend or a friend, or a hot shower or a kiss on my neck. If I were a robot, I'd be fueled by neck kisses and hugs, I think.
Oh, thanks. So maybe chips. Yeah, that's it really. I've got to say before that I can be thankful for those things because I'm not really poor and I don't have any horrific trauma in my life. And I think that's kind of important to say, because sometimes when people are like, oh, you know, just relax and just enjoy this, it's like, I mean, if you can't pay your bills and you've got three kids to feed, that's not going to happen. Like, there needs to be a level of income before I think like contentment like that can come. But I am really thankful. I get really excited by things like that. And maybe it's because like I've managed to travel like a lot, I think, but not, I've never, you know, done a sort of gap year, toured the world, backpacked, stuff like that. I've lived in other countries. I've done lots of things like that, but I don't regularly go on like holidays and stuff. And I just get so excited by certain things. And maybe I think lockdown has encouraged that in me, obviously, like being able to go the other day and just sit in a cafe and have somebody give me a cup of tea. So excited. I do think I get a little bit sexually excited. Not really, but there's like, it's the same tingling in the body, really. I think we separate this stuff all the time, but there's a tingling that's like so good. And I also think that is something from living on your own as an adult, that you don't, and I know some people will maybe be listening to me, well, I don't get that anyway off my partner. You know, there's not always lovely, loving aspects of relationships. I know a lot of people living with partners that they don't possibly get on with that well, but I just thought, oh, just having someone else make me a cup of tea is like bliss, or somebody else cooking me dinner. And my daughter, I like have put it on her like list of stuff she's got to do. She does her own washing, cleans her own room and stuff, and make me a cup of tea on Sunday is like one thing, because it's just so nice, somebody bringing you a cup of tea, like little thing like that. I just absolutely love it. I get very excited, and cafes really excite me. It's funny when everything opens up and you realize what you're excited by, isn't it? Like I don't care that hairdressers are open. I never really go to the hairdresser. I don't care that gyms are open for me, but the idea of being able to go to like a pub and sit in the garden and have a like glass of wine and a plate of chips is like overwhelming.
A lot of people will really agree and relate to that, and it's something I was talking to one of my colleagues at Happiful about. Kat, we were talking about the fact that both of us love to go and write from cafes on our own, but the idea that someone has made us a nice cup of coffee and we're kind of surrounded by people going yeah. about their lives doing things and seeing that other life and other lives are happening and being yeah. with people but not with people,
yeah,
and
that's
writing,
exactly like me.
I love it. Do you do that too?
Yeah, I do it, because my like, not, I don't mean in a way, but my life is quite solitary in general. Like if my daughter's at school, then I'm on my own at home. I work yeah. from home. If I'm touring, like my boyfriend often meets me in different places, which is lovely. Not always. So quite often I'll be touring on my own. I stand on stage and you know, read stuff on my own, and you're with people, but it's still, you're still on your own really. Then you go back to a hotel room on your own. So like everything I do, I don't really have colleagues.
Of course.
Yeah. A lot of the time. Like editors are so nice to work with. My agent's amazing, and we get on really well. But generally, and I live in a little village. So the idea, like a lot of people I know sort of meet for like a work lunch and stuff, but I can't do that. I've got to do the school run and then I've got to be back for the school run. So I live like an hour and a half from London, which is where a lot of stuff like that happens. Yeah. So yeah, I love going to cafes and I just love interacting with random people. It's so nice. And I really missed strangers in lockdown more than it wouldn't have even crossed my mind that I would miss random conversations with somebody working in the cafe that I go to quite a lot. But I missed that as much, I think, as I missed my family and friends, because I guess you were still chatting to family and friends. I made a pact when you could only get takeaways that I cycled. It's like a half hour cycle into the city centre in Cambridge. So I'd cycle there on days that I didn't have a massive workload. So Monday, I normally give myself as the weekend, because the weekend I'm with my daughter and coaching and still do quite a lot of work. And I cycled in and I bought myself cheese toasty, which was amazing. And then a cup of tea, and I sat in the park and ate it on my own. And two women walked past and somebody said, "Oh, that looks delicious." And then I was like, "Yes, it is delicious." And then she was like, "Oh, where did you get it from?" And after she left, we just had like a literally 1 minute talk about the cheese toasty and how nice it was having a cheese toasty. That was it. And then I was like, great, right, I can cycle back. I'm like spoken to someone. This is really nice. I just really like it. I normally chat to people on trains when I'm on tour. Not annoyingly, I sit next to people that look chatty if I feel like chatting. But yeah, it's just lovely. I think there are some real bastard people in the world, but I am quite hopeful that most people are lovely.
I think it makes the world a smaller and a nicer place when you talk to strangers as well.
Yeah.
It's amazing how the kindness of strangers can really change your day.
Really change. But I think having a young baby, it was never so apparent as then for me. Yeah. Like, oh, going, walking around with the baby and having, yeah, just one person saying something nice to me, or one person saying, "Oh, are you okay?" or like anything. After I'd been to the toilet to breastfeed, I was walking around another time because I didn't want to go and sit in the toilet again, but I just couldn't find anywhere that I could go and sit. And a vicar from one of the churches in the middle of the city centre saw me sort of running around panicking with a baby screaming and said, "Are you looking for somewhere to feed? Do you want to come into the church?" And so I went and sat in his office each time I went into town, just knocked on the door. And that was, so him, I don't know where to find him now. He's not there. And I've never really said a proper thank you, because I was always in such a panic. But that was just like, oh, that's amazing. Like, it little is. Things like that. Oh, yeah. And it was so good. You just remember that. It's good to, I get quite a lot of hate, like online or on, just in general, having a bit of a, you know, online presence slightly. But it's good, isn't it, to remember just all those people who have, like, for me, like, offered to help with the buggy, or someone gave me a free macaroni cheese on one of the Virgin trains. I remember once, because he said it was so nice seeing me and my daughter play cards, and they didn't have any macaroni cheese left, but they had some in first class, so he got me the first class one, and I was like, pretty much made my year. That's it.
But see, isn't it like the swimming and the frazzles and the, you know, not being able to stop unless you're at a curb?
Yeah.
Talking to people, it's those human experiences, you know, that we carry with us.
And totally.
That's the flip side of the shitness of society.
Yeah, kind but of then pressure. You've got to, totally. You've got to be that person, don't you? If I think that guy made my day, you don't know whose day you could make or ruin just by being a dick to somebody. I always think that as well. Like, you have no idea what that person's gone through. So just smile at people. Like, you just don't know if this could be like the worst day of their life, and now you're being an ass to them.
I love that. I am. And we're going to finish with your I have, which is, I have my mother to thank for a lot of my happiness or contentment, I think, and chips
and microchips in my younger years, definitely.
So tell us about your mum.
So my mum is just amazing. She's very incredible, and she's always been a very loving and lovely mother, which both my parents have been. But the reason I say my mum to thank for this is because she really drummed it into me to be content with what I had, like really drummed it into me as a kid, as an adult. And I remember her saying, if you can be sort of content, like walking in a forest or looking at a tree, or, you know, sharing and having a chat with somebody, then you're always going to be all right. Not no matter how poor you are, there is a level of basic poverty, which that I don't think works for. But after a certain level, like, there's a really good graph of happiness. I did economics as my degree, like my master's, and I'd always remember this sort of graph of governments trying to sort of work out income versus happiness graph, and they measured it with certain things, with sort of rates of depression, but also rates of literacy and maternal deaths, these sort of things. And it was like, from a sort of basic very very poverty level, it went up. Like, income really really increased people's happiness up to a certain level when you had enough money to be comfortable and also to have money for a few like social outings and stuff you don't need. And after that, didn't really make a difference. So after a certain level of wealth, the more wealthy you got after that, happiness didn't increase at all. It increased a lot at first, but then not, which I always found quite amazing because you're sort of convinced that if I had like another million now, I would be much happier. But I don't think that's the case. And my mum's a nurse. I think this is why this happened. So every day she saw so many people, you know, chatted to so many different people from all walks of life. People died a lot. They had illnesses that she had to help with. She saw, you know, from new babies every day to people at the end of their life. So like everything we did, she would just like, I guess an example, every time we go out for a meal, she's like, God, aren't we lucky to do this? And it's become a bit of a running joke now. It's like, yeah, wait for mum to say, aren't we lucky that we can like go out and like eat out. But it's true. So she always was saying things like that. And her mum and dad were not rich at all. So she wasn't brought up with money. And I think that mixed with being a nurse, and every time I'd complain, like not in a dismissive way, but I remember once I was really upset because I had no boobs when I was a teenager and I wanted a dress for like our sixth form, like end of year thing. And I was like, everything looks terrible. I remember saying I looked like I did a little sport and I thought I looked like a sort of young muscly boy in a dress, and I was all upset about it. And she wasn't dismissive of stuff like that at all. Like she went out to this charity shop and got a load of tops that could go with this skirt for me to try on. It was so sweet. But she was also like, Holly, I've got a girl your age who at the moment is going through chemotherapy. Like, please put stuff in perspective, and not like using other people's misery, but just being like, please, like this is really not the end of things. And I'm not taking it seriously, but just know that this happened to me today. So this is why I'm not like, oh, that's awful, because it's not awful.
Yes.
it's fine actually. And she was still very helpful and supportive with all these things that are quite trivial, but they don't seem trivial at the time, do they? And it shouldn't necessarily be like, oh, somebody else has got it worse, therefore I can't ever complain or ever feel sad, which is unhelpful as well. But it was just that, and just talking to her a lot about her work and patience just did always make me think, you're really lucky. That is, yeah. So I think that's why. That's why. And for her love, obviously, but that kind of mentality, I think, is good, especially because I don't do anything like that in my job. Like, I do not help people like that, like she did. So yeah, I think that was a very good upbringing mentality.
Sounds like she helped you to kind of zoom out and see wider than your own life, but also that appreciation, yeah, for the small things. It's really interesting, you know, her saying, aren't we lucky? It's that kind of thing that actually, if you, even though you kind of wait for it with her now, it's that kind of thing that when you say it, it's like when you recognize it, you start to feel it, you know, you start to kind of think, yeah, I'm going to enjoy this. There is something about that verbalizing when something is good, because it's easy to not do it until something is.
Yeah, and it's easy to be jealous all the time, like of people that have got it better, especially now with all, you know, social media and stuff online. But it's mainly about money. And actually, you have no idea if that person living in that massive house is any happier. You just don't know.
We don't know.
Your mom not has... saying I wouldn't like a pool. I'd like a swimming pool, but the public pool is just as good. And I bump into people there and they serve chips, which wouldn't happen if I had my own swimming pool. So,
but do they have Frazzles in the vending machine? Because I'm not going in this.
they do have Frazzles, and they have Monster Munch pickled onion, which is my favourite.
Oh, Holly, I've loved talking to you, and we've come to the final question, which is, if you could meet Holly in 10 years' time, what do you hope she would say to you?
I hope she would say, wow, that was a good 10 years, wasn't it? Yeah, that's a good 10 years. Brilliant.
I love that answer. And I'm now going to ask you to do the bit which I know you're not the biggest fan of, but can you tell us where people can find you, about the new book, and where they can find info about your tour?
Yes. So the new book is called Slug and Other Things I've Been Told to Hate. And it's a book of poems and stories about myself, and also just short stories as well about all those things that I've been told to sort of keep quiet about, like grief and like mirrors or my reflection or masturbation or blood, but which I actually find really helpful to write about and talk about And that is out on May the 13th. It's out on audiobook already, which I read. If you want to find anything about my tours or anything, then like at Holly with an IE, because I'm named after the Hollies. So Holly with an IE poetry is pretty much my social media handle and everything, or hollypoetry.com. And then all my live dates for the tours will be up there.
Amazing. And you're off to Hay on Wye as well, virtually.
Yes, I'm off to Hay on Wye. I think I'm actually going there, but it's going to be virtually shared with other people. So yeah, it is so exciting to get on a train or get in the car and go somewhere out of my village.
I look forward to watching. I wish I were coming in person, but hopefully next year. Thank you, yeah. Holly. I've really loved our chat today.
Thanks a lot. Lovely to meet you.
Thank you for listening to I Am, I Have. Don't forget to download the free Happiful app, and we'd really love it if you could rate, review and subscribe to our podcast too. Before you go, I wanted to let you know that on happiful.com we have information about where you can find mental health support, including the counselling directory and charities. If you need immediate help, Samaritans are open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on 116 123. Or you can email jo@samaritans.org. Help is available. This podcast is hosted and produced by me, Lucy Donoghue, for Happiful. I hope you'll listen again soon.